Good morning. Welcome to USIP and to this event on elections in the Congo. I'll be turning it over shortly to Ambassador Chester Crocker soon, but I just wanted to welcome you. Chester Crocker is a professor at Georgetown, where he teaches and researches on conflict management and regional security issues. He is also a member of our board here at USIP. And from 1981 to 1989 was the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. So without further ado, because we are a few minutes delayed, I'm going to turn it over to Chester Crocker.
Thank you very much, Darina. Welcome, everybody, to this important session on elections in the DRC. Very glad to have this good turnout here this morning. Let me say just a word or two about the setting for our meeting, and then I'm going to say a word or two about some ground rules. But the main ground rule I'll start with is to turn off those machines. It is the case that Africa is the fastest growing cell phone market in the world. But this is a place which doesn't tolerate cell phones. So if you would please oblige us, that would be great. It would be a courtesy to our speaker and the fellow members of our audience. What is at stake in this election in the Congo is obviously of very significant importance. This is a major watershed with huge upside, potential upside or potential downside implications for the future of the Congo, for the future of Africa, and I would argue for Africa's international situation. I don't think I need to tell this audience of people who know the region well that the Congo is one of Africa's pivotal countries. It has been in some considerable turmoil for many, many years. I don't need to spell that out either. But ever since we lost our way in Somalia and then in Rwanda in the 1990s, the Congo has been in turmoil itself. But getting gradually back on its feet because of the actions of Congolese, because of the action of Africans, because of the actions of the international community. And it's really a very interesting story, the interactions between African diplomacy, Congolese diplomacy and peacemaking, UN diplomacy, which we'll hear a lot about this morning, and that of key members of the UN system acting unilaterally or in coalitions of the willing. I would argue that the Congo story is at least as important as the Sudan story. They're both very, very important. Sudan has gotten the lion's share of the attention for reasons that I won't go into here this morning in terms of the American political process. Congo deserves to be right up there with it, and it's very gratifying to those of us who have followed the Congo story that we have people as qualified and as committed and as experienced as our lead speaker, Ambassador Bill Swing, to help shepherd this transition. The issues I will let Bill Swing describe and our commentator, Bemidji Zoleli, describe. I won't go into the substance, at least I won't unless I'm sorely tempted at a subsequent point. But the issues are pretty straightforward, I think, and anybody who's been following this story knows that there are lots of issues at this key juncture in the Congolese transition. So we're going to have an opening presentation by Ambassador Bill Swing, followed by a comment from Bemidji Zoleli, and I'll introduce both of them now to you a little bit more formally, and then I'll say a word on ground rules and give Bill Swing the microphone. Ambassador Swing, as your bio material indicates, was sworn in as a Kofi Annan Special Representative for the Congo in May of 2003, coming directly from another assignment of similar challenge and difficulty, another intractable situation known as the Western Sahara, where he served for several years as UN Special Representative. Ambassador Swing, before he became a UN Special Representative, is a 40-year veteran of the United States Foreign Service with a very distinguished career spanning many different assignments, chief of mission in Africa in five different African countries, as your material, your bio material indicates, as well as to Haiti. He served in many places, many difficult assignments, many challenging assignments. I first met Bill Swing when he was chief of mission in Brazzaville in 1981. And at the end of our discussions with the then head of government, I looked at Bill and said, is this guy for real? I'm talking about the current president of the Congo. I said to Bill, is this guy for real? And Ambassador Swing, ever the diplomat, said, you better believe he's for real. Get used to him. He might be around for a while. President Sassou Nguesso has been around for a while. And we did get used to him, as the history books will tell. He then moved on to serve as our chief of mission in Monrovia in Liberia from 81 to 85, where we worked very closely together, and many other assignments. The UN and the US and the international community and the people of the DRC are fortunate that Bill is continuing his important service. After Bill speaks, we'll have some commentary from Mr. Mbemba Dizolele, who is a freelance independent journalist working as Africa editor for the World Security Network. Mbemba, whom I've come to know since he was an analyst and a researcher at the Center for Global Development here in Washington, is working on, I think, completing or almost completed a biography that we'll all want to read about the life and times of President Mobutu, Mobutu, the Rise and Fall of the Leopard King. I will not attempt to describe what that effort entails. I'll let Mbemba do that. So he will make some comments after Ambassador Swing has spoken, and we will then open it up for some discussion with you all. The ground rules for our meeting today are that people will be given the opportunity to approach that microphone over there when they have a question, and we are going to do questions. We're not going to do speeches. We're not going to do sermons. We're going to do questions for the panel, and the questions, please, will be in English. And those are the ground rules. If I think of other ground rules as I go along, I will share them with you. Thank you very much. And Bill Swing, the floor is yours.
Thank you.
You may stand if you like. Or
no, I will. Thank you very much, Chad. Thanks so much. Good morning. And what a real honor it is to be given this opportunity. And both in terms of my introduction to the U.S. Institute for Peace physically. I mean, I know a lot about the Institute, and I've read more about it recently on the Internet, but it's a double honor also to be here in the presence of someone who's been my boss several times. I also recall another occasion when Dr. Crocker came back from his first meeting with Samuel Doe, and he came back and he said, let's go down to the pool. We put our swimming trunks on and went down to the pool, and we talked, and we tried to settle one another down, because that first meeting is always a memorable one, shall we say. I wanted to try to make this a fairly interactive and lively session, and I apologize for imposing on you some technology, but we did about a 15-minute video which I used with the Security Council when I briefed them last. It's still very current. And I thought for some who have never been to the Congo or who haven't been there recently, that it would give you some sense of the scope of both the transition in the Congo as well as this large peacekeeping mission called MONUC, which, of course, is the French acronym for the United Nations mission in the Congo. So I don't know if we could roll that video. Can you bring it up? You're still working on it? Okay, then. If that's possible, we can show it afterwards.
How long are we going to need, do you think?
Sorry.
We're working on it.
Yeah, yeah. I also, you know, when David Aronson and I spoke either by email or phone several times about coming here. And I've been trying to come here, I think, for at least a year. And poor David was about to give up on me. We agreed on a date, and we said, well, let's quickly agree on a topic, and I agreed to talk about elections. But I think you will appreciate that it's very hard to go into elections without giving a little bit of background. So a lot of what I'm going to say is about what led up to the elections, and then obviously we can devote the entire question and answer period to elections if you would like to. But I don't want to short change you on the elections, but I think we need to talk about sort of how we got there. All right, thank you for your patience. I apologize for the length of the video. Let me now try to go through a few of the issues rather quickly and leave lots of time for questions and answers. I think I was told we have till about 12. I've re-entitled what I want to say to you, basically called War, Peace, and International Engagement in the Congo. At the end of the Cold War, there was, I don't know if it was a scholarly debate, but there's certainly a large discussion as to what was likely to fill the vacuum left by the Cold War. And it didn't take very long for reality to replace rhetoric as regional and interstate conflicts began to appear in various parts of the world, along with global cross-cutting issues, whether it was HIV/AIDS, terrorism, narcotics, etc. And the end of the Cold War also saw in its wake the collapse of state institutions across Africa, Liberia, Somalia, Sierra Leone, the Congo, and others. Disputes over natural resources fueled armed conflicts, and these evolved into guerrilla warfare, including foreign-sponsored militias, mercenaries, and forced recruitment of children. Central Africa, where I've had the great privilege of spending a fairly good portion of my career, has long been a region of chronic instability and conflict. In fact, I think you could make the case that very few subregions in Africa, if not in the world, have experienced greater conflict than the subregion of Central Africa. The international community alone, if I speak now, define it to the UN, we've deployed no fewer than 10 peacekeeping missions or specialized missions to address 7 major conflicts in Angola, Burundi, Republic of Congo, Congo-Brazzaville, that is, 2 wars in Zaire/DRC, a continuing low-intensity conflict in Uganda, genocide in Rwanda in 1994, and 3 successive coup d'etats in yet another Central African country. The genuine elections have been very few until recently. Conflicts and instability have claimed millions of lives, left millions of others displaced from their homes. Economies in the region have collapsed to, or in many cases such as the DRC, below independence levels. And against this historical backdrop, therefore, there are very few issues in Africa of greater urgency today than that of building a stable Central African region. I was very pleased to have the statement this morning from Dr. Crocker about the relationship of conflicts such as Sudan and the DRC. And while I am grossly aware of my own parochialism, one of the messages I bring and one of the arguments I wish to make is that of all the conflicts in Africa, if you had to choose one that absolutely had to be solved, I would argue that it is the DRC, for the reason that will be evident, not only the tremendous humanitarian suffering, making it one of the greatest humanitarian tragedies since the Second World War, but also the fact that if you look all over Africa today, the only subregion that lacks any center of political stability is Central Africa. You can point to places in West Africa, East Africa, and virtually all of Southern Africa, where you have maybe 8 or 9 of the 14 member states of SADC who are either democracies or striving to be one. But in Central Africa, it's largely lacking, and the only country that can give Central Africa that stability, in my argument, is really the Congo. This is a vast area, stretching from the Gulf of Guinea to the Great Lakes of Africa, from Yaoundé to Kampala, Kigali or Kigoma, from Luanda and Libreville on the coast to Lubumbashi and Lusaka, and from Bangui to Bukavu and Bujumbura, the one sub-region that lacks a center of political gravity. Now, at the epicenter of all of this has long been the Congo, formerly known as Zaire, covering an area the size of Western Europe. Do we have some slides here? We have some. Do you have some? Sorry. I'm sure we can get them. If we don't, worry. I can give you a set of the slides afterwards. I love PowerPoint, and I've been accused of not being able to talk when the electricity goes off, but I will try. It's an area the size of the United States east of the Mississippi, Western Europe before the expansion, and sharing a border with nine neighbors reaching into southern, eastern, and northern Africa. Located in the heart of Africa, it's endowed with more than 50% of all the remaining tropical forests, 10 to 12% of the world's hydroelectric capacity, and has been in the top 10 in the past in terms of five or six major minerals, including gold, industrial diamonds, copper, cobalt, coltan, etc., some of the world's richest deposits. And yet the cruel irony of Congo's history is that one of Africa's potentially richest countries has now become one of the world's poorest. It's in the bottom six or seven on the UNDP scale. So looking for a moment to the Congo conflict, the two wars that raged from 1997 to 2002, I was there from 98 to 2001, and followed the sad legacy that these wars caused until the first peace agreement, the Lusaka Accords of July 1999. You had a country that was divided into three different belligerent administrations. I had an email once from someone who I highly respect in our foreign service, a very senior person, who shall go unnamed. He referred to it as the Congo which shall never again be reunited. And yet the one fundamental fact that comes out from the two wars is that the Congolese people have maintained their national unity. They want to be one, and every Congolese wants to be a Congolese, even though you can get the Swahili broadcast from East Africa and can get no broadcast from Kinshasa. They know what it is to be a Congolese. Armies of six foreign nations plundering bits and pieces of the DRC, wide-scale plunder of the natural resources. We've already heard 3.8 million dead, largely from indirect causes of the war. About the same number of displaced persons, a half million refugees in all nine of the neighboring countries. A country that had a very low prevalence of HIV/AIDS is now soared to 2.4 million. Infrastructure of the country destroyed. Basically, the challenge that faced us all at that time was how to put together a process in the country where everything was broken, literally, except the human spirit, and in which every sector and element of life is a legitimate priority. So when someone comes to me with a new priority, I'm never surprised, and I always agree. It is a priority. Everything is a priority. Of course, we've had to set priorities, and we'll talk about those. So why did one finally decide to become involved? I think there were several considerations. I've already mentioned one of the world's largest living tragedies, tremendous economic potential, and the fact that Central Africa desperately needs a stable Congo with legitimate institutions. The peace process, my next point, the emergence of the peace process. When you ask why the United Nations was so reluctant to come in, and I remember with a number of the ambassadors there, trying to make life miserable in New York for the Security Council and the Secretariat, saying, get us an SRSG, get us a peacekeeping mission. It's perhaps the same reason you don't have NGOs, international NGOs, beating the door down to come into the Congo. I think they're simply overwhelmed by the size of the country and the size of the challenge. You can go into, and I have enormous respect for what's been accomplished in Burundi and Liberia and Sierra Leone, and the efforts are being made elsewhere. And I'm sorry my slide isn't there, but I can tell you that of the 18 peacekeeping missions in the world, if you set aside Ethiopia, Eritrea, which is two countries, all of the other countries will fit inside either Sudan or the Congo. So what I'm saying to you is it's gone unperceived. The United Nations is doing something it has never done before, which is peacekeeping on a massive scale. Massive countries, basically like a continent, each with a large population. The Congo with about 58 million, of course no census since 1984, but I'll stay with that figure, and the Sudan with 40 million plus. Now, what does this suggest to you? What it suggests to me is we've got an issue here, and we'll need your help here if you believe in that it's important to stay in the Congo. You get an issue of cost versus sustainability. And the bane of my existence has been, as a diplomat, is I'm given a problem that only knows a medium to long-term solution. I'm given short-term commitment, a one-year budget, and the final parting words, good luck. So if we believe in this, we must understand that it is true Article 198 of the Constitution says the election and inauguration of a national president will mark the end of the transition. True, but false in the sense it will not mark the end of the transitional tasks. You've accomplished voter registration. You've had a good referendum. We expect you're going to have good elections, but you will not have an army. You will not have a police force. You'll have 10 to 12,000 foreign armed elements, largely from Rwanda, still inside the country. You will not have finished the DDR program. Extension of state authority will not have been accomplished. So while you will finish the transition, the transitional task will still be there to await you. So what happened in setting up this process was there was war fatigue. There was an attrition of the belligerents. It was palpable. There was no military solution in sight for anyone. These are the geographical challenges we talked about. That's the overlay of the maps, which is accurate. It doesn't include my home of Miami, but that's all right. Continent, that's the overlay on Europe. Next one, please. Afghanistan, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Cambodia, and Cote d'Ivoire. Haiti fit inside. There's probably room for, let's say, Germany or France in there still. But this is the challenge that we face also in Sudan. This is not going to be accomplished overnight. Next one. Unprecedented UN peacekeeping scale. The humanitarian challenge I've already dealt with. Next one. More of the same. Next. Next one. Those are the three reasons that we go in. Now, I wanted to say that although we are heavily engaged, all of us, because we're all the United Nations, right? All of us. We are heavily engaged as an international community. This has remained a quintessentially African process, and it needs to remain the same. It shows you how important it is to work with regional actors. We come in from the outside. The regional actors are extremely important. You know, there was another debate on the eve of the demise of apartheid. Dr. Crocker will correct me, but my memory is that there was a lot of discussion. Which way will South Africa go in a post-apartheid period? Will they look inward? Will they look outward? You had what F.W. de Klerk used to call the socioeconomic backlogs. They had enough at home to occupy them. Fortunately, the minority of those of us who believe they would look outward in the end proved to be right, and we're very grateful for that. President Mbeki's engagement has been extremely important in this. President Masiri, President Obasanjo, Sassou Nguesso now, President Konare, people like Chissano, Dos Santos, many, many others have remained engaged on the issue, and it's still there. That's extremely important in this process. So from the outset, it was a quintessentially African process, must remain such. Each of the five peace accords was negotiated by Africans in an African city for Africans. All of them bear the name of an African city, whether it be Pretoria. I guess you can call it Sun City a city. Okay, Sun City. And SADC, the sub-regional organization, SADC, as well as the African Union, have remained very engaged in this whole question. And there's also a strong regional element, and since you can't change your geography or your neighbors, in this business, you've got to change your policies and your approach. And there are a number of confidence-building mechanisms in the region that I can talk about in a moment. We've also got a better context overall because six or seven of the nine neighbors have now conducted elections. Next one, please. But you see that large red corridor, Sudan, DRC, Angola. I'm not going to argue about these elections, whether the observers thought they were good or bad. They've had elections at the point. And now we've got three. DRC will be the first because it's coming up on 30 July, whereas Sudan is, I guess, about 5 years away from the referendum. But it is a much more favorable climate than we had before. I would also argue that the support of the international community today for the Congolese transitional process is the strongest since independence in 1960. It would be extremely difficult to put this coalition of international forces together again anytime soon. It's very strong. And the problem the Congo faces in part is there is no lead nation. Liberia and Haiti have the United States. Cote d'Ivoire has France. Sudan has everybody. And the Congo is difficult there to come up with the lead nation. But it's a very important concept. So you've got to keep this coalition, this alliance together, a common alliance of interest in seeing stability in Central Africa. The initial feeble response, I mean, we came in initially with fewer than 100 people. I was there. They were riding around in town in rented vehicles without cell phones, thank goodness, I should say, perhaps. But to the point now that MONUC has become the United Nations' largest peacekeeping mission, probably on record in almost every category. It took a while to get there, but we are now at a level of 17,000 troops. We will use the ONUB quota, since ONUB is downsizing, we will use the ONUB, the Burundi quota, until the end of the year to bring in a Pakistani battalion for north and central Katanga and to bring in a battalion of Beninois, trained and equipped by the Belgians. They are now in place in Katanga. So that allows us to move up in the range between 18,000 and 19,000 troops. And unfortunately, because the country is so vast and has no infrastructure, one-third to one-fourth of our budget of $1.13 billion now goes for logistics. And when we start looking, the problem will be that, and I'll show you near the end a slide on this, the problem will be that when we're asked, say, okay, we've had elections, people immediately think of that as the exit strategy. And I keep saying, I want you to talk more about a sustainment strategy. And I remember going out to Haiti, the first thing that the Pentagon wanted to talk to me about was the exit strategy. I said, well, let's talk about the entry strategy first. So we have to understand that that this is going to require a sustaining quality to our support. I guess the reason one should be encouraged about the elections is twofold. One, I've mentioned the international support. The $422 million that is required for these elections is largely there. It was $103 million alone for electoral security, $110 million to register. But it's more than anything else. It is the ardent desire of the Congolese people to have these elections. Why do I say that? Because I have prima facie evidence. The highest estimate anyone ever made of the electorate of Congo was 28 million. They registered 25.6 million. Now, these are people, many of whom walked 30 to 40 kilometers, many of them young women with a baby on their back, child maybe at their hand here, older people who might have voted in 1960, might have not, but this was it. They were determined to get that card. And then two-thirds of that nearly 26 million went out on a single day and voted 84% for the Constitution, a piece of paper most had never seen, very few had ever read, because they knew that that's the next step to get to election. So I think I'm on pretty solid ground. I say that they want these elections ardently. The process in the Congo, I think, has been a solid one for three reasons. First of all, we have an international juridical framework. We have the five peace accords. We have 32 UN Security Council resolutions, as many Security Council presidential statements and Secretary General's reports, et cetera. Secondly, we have the mechanisms. I mentioned MONUC, which is now the largest peacekeeping mission. It'll shortly, I'm sure, be overtaken by Sudan. That'll make me feel better because then there'll be less focus on my budget and more on theirs. we have the CIOT, which is the French acronym for the International Committee to Support the Transition, which is a group of 16 ambassadors. I'm not the chairman. I convene it. It meets at MONUC. We meet every Thursday afternoon at 4, and we meet more often if there's a particular crisis. We make trips together. You saw a picture of the CIOT ambassadors visiting in South Kivu. Whenever we needed, we're there. We're there basically. And it's very different from anything the UN has done before. It is not a group of friends of the Secretary General for country X, which is a good concept, but it doesn't have any particular muscle. Whereas the CIOT is in Annex 4 to the Global and Inclusive Accord. So it makes us basically co-responsible with the transitional institutions for the success or failure. Thanks, Jeff. Or failure of the transition. We're right now considering, okay, what happens after, since we go out with the end of the transition, what happens to us? I mean, I don't mean physically. We have also, there are regional mechanisms. There's a joint verification commission that has two joint verification teams, Congolese and Rwandan, based across the border. Goma on the Congolese side, Gisenyi in Rwanda, Bukavu on the Congolese side, and Changugu in Rwanda. Not functioning as well as it should. The commission hasn't met for a long time. It's unfortunate, but the teams work. They go after allegations. And the first 22 they investigated, 20 were not substantiated. And that's not bad. The idea of the commission was confidence building. There's a very good mechanism that Washington initiated in August of 2004 called the Tripartite Commission. And now since the Burundian elections, it's called the Tripartite Plus One. No one at State could tell me why it's not called the Quadripartite, but anyway, it's the Tripartite Plus One. It meets, it just met in Bujumbura, and it's a very effective mechanism. They've created an intelligence fusion cell whereby former countries that formerly weren't exactly copacetic on issues, now share intelligence across the board, strong support from Washington. MONUC takes part in it in the African Union, and I think you'll hear more about that. It has its site in Kisangani, where we have our divisional headquarters. Is there another slide here? Am I missing something? Next one. This is what I was trying to show you about the size of the countries, as you can see here. I have to go back and forth to catch up with my slides. But you can see here, this, of course, over here is Ethiopia, Eritrea. Here you've got Sudan, Congo. And these will all fit inside either one of them. Not to belittle, but to say the scale of operations we've simply never done before. And we'll see now if we can continue to get the kind of international support that will be necessary. Let me move now and try to quickly come to a closure so we have time left to discuss. Let me talk quickly about the elections and a new political order. Next slide, please. Those are the frameworks I talked about. Next one. This is the legislative framework. They've passed all the legislation that's required for the elections. These laws can wait till after the elections. So the legal framework for the elections is set. That's the transitional parliament, an unelected parliament chosen on the basis of the transitional constitution. Next one, please. This is the foreign armed group problem. These are the FDLR, is the Interahamwe and XFAR involved in the genocide of 1994, about 8,000, maybe more. The Ugandans, the ADF Nalu, are largely in the northeastern corridor between Uganda and Beni Butembo. A smaller group, a lessening group, this is the group that we supported the Congolese army in combating over the Christmas, New Year's period. Unfortunately, there were overall about 86 of this group that chose not to surrender and were killed. The Burundians are becoming less and less of a problem because there are discussions going on in FNL. There are not many of them. They traverse Lake Tanganyika around Uvira from time to time. But slowly this is being taken into hand, and we are trying to combine military, political, and international legal pressure against them. The leader, Ignace Mwanashaka from Rwanda, who's headquartered in Germany, was arrested in Mannheim here several weeks ago. He's out on bail now, but will have to face charges, and we are working to get others arrested too. Next one, please. That's the pressures I talked about. Next, please. Some of the camps being burned. Okay, next. So as you can see, we've repatriated about 13,000, two-thirds of them Rwandan, about two-thirds of them combatants, and about one-third family members. And this is the numbers on those who have been killed in combat. So we've not done with this yet, but we will be moving toward it. Next one. See, what happened here was, this was the upsurge. We quadrupled our numbers from December 2003 till April 2004. But we've been largely straight-lined. I can't take this graph back to the Security Council and say, because they say, well, under that, you'd take another 8 years. Well, I won't be there 8 years from now, so we need to do it now. Next one. This is the task of building the army. These are the old three. Here you've got three old, these are the old Belgian bases, Mobutu bases, Kitona, Kamina, Kinshasa. Three new army integration centers, Nialeki and Rumangabo in North Kivu, and Lubirizi in South Kivu. That's where the army integration is taking place. A lot of international support for the training and not enough for the question of equipment and logistics. The idea was to have 18 brigades trained and ready to go by the time of the elections. We finished the second wave, which gives you 12 brigades, and they're trying to do another six before the elections. That's not really the issue anymore. It's really the issue of the quality of the support for these new brigades so that there is an administrative structure to ensure salary payment and rations and to ensure adequate vehicle and logistical support. I'm sorry, I had to go back to catch up a little bit on these because I thought that would better illustrate. Please, next. Okay. On the elections, let me just say that these are the largest elections that the United Nations has ever assisted by far. There are 53,000 voting sites, 300,000 election workers to be trained, 169 individual ballots, more than 9,000 candidates for 500 parliamentary seats, and 33 candidates for president. So the ballots alone will be a very complicated affair. We're very pleased to see that South Africa has come through very handsomely on this. They've agreed to do the ballots. They've had a lot of experience, a lot of elections recently, including local elections on March 1. This will mean that South Africa will provide the paper and the transport to 14 hubs inside the Congo, which will allow Monarch aircraft, which now stand at 86, both fixed wing and rotary, will allow us then to do the secondary and tertiary distribution. So it's a technical, it's a real complicated task, and the financing is difficult. But the elections, I think, from a technical and financial point of view, things are more or less in hand. A lot of work to be done, but we can see that it can be done. But each time it's more difficult, because for voter registration, the Electoral Commission was able to, they had 5 months to do it, from June 20 until right before the referendum on 18 December. The referendum was another challenge because you had to do everything on one day, but you had a simple ballot, yes or no. Now you every electoral district will have a different ballot because you're looking at parliamentarian from that area, and the parliament will then be 500 seats, but you'd be a difficult challenge. And I think the Electoral Commission is certainly able to do it, and we will give them every support. It's also the largest, in that sense, the largest elections the UN has ever done from the point of view of challenge. It's also the largest electorate. We have about 5 million more registered voters in the Congo than in South Africa. South Africa has an electorate of about 20 million, so it's even more. But it's also done in an area without roads. The registration of candidates for the provincial assemblies has begun and will conclude, I think it's on the 23rd of June, as I remember. And those are important elections because the senators in the parliament will be selected by the provincial assemblies. There have been a lot of efforts to make sure that the electoral process is politically inclusive, very important. Everyone who's been out there, whether it was the Secretary General himself, or Mr. Solana, various others who've come out, have insisted on political inclusivity. In this regard, more than about 218 political parties are legally registered and have presented candidates for the parliamentary elections. A historical opposition party, UDPS, which has been was founded 26 years ago and played a major role in the departure of Mobutu, has decided at the end of the day not to take part in the electoral process, despite efforts by many international leaders and on the ground in Kinshasa to encourage their participation and to ensure that all legal or technical hurdles from participating were removed. It's very regrettable because it would have been better to have had them in the process. They still have an opportunity to come in at the provincial level if they choose to do so. But the people's determination and the strong international support are such that people now recognize, including the former belligerent leaders, that whatever their particular political agenda may be, it is much better accomplished within the process than breaking out of it. And several times those who've tried to break out have found that they received strong pressure from the international community to stay in. I've covered a lot of the other points through the PowerPoint. I'm not going to read you what I have in my text here. Knowing you prefer the written word here, I have a text I want to give you, whatever it's worth. But I wanted to be a little more free form to get some of these points across perhaps somewhat better. The challenge then becomes doing the elections, making sure that there is general agreement on a code of conduct, that there is access to the media, that we have enough observers on the ground. I'm very pleased that I know that the Carter Center is out there already, just established an office. The European Union is sending in about 300. There'll be a lot of observers coming from the Southern African Development Community and from South Africa itself. I think other countries will be sending, and it would be very good because it's with 53,000 voting sites and 11 provinces, there will be a major need for observers. And increasingly then our thoughts in New York at the UN and at Monuc in Kinshasa are turning to discussions with the government, with other leaders, as to what happens after the elections. It's extremely important that leaders recognize now the importance of being as inclusive as possible following the elections so you don't end up with a winner-take-all situation with the earlier context of a couple of wars, 15, 20 years of chronic instability, and about 40 years of economic and political mismanagement. Not a great context to go winner-take-all. So keeping the idea of inclusivity in there. As far as the UN peacekeeping mission that I'm very privileged and honored to head, our thoughts are already going in that direction, what happens. And I generally say to everyone, It depends first and foremost on two absolutely major considerations. What will a new government, a newly elected government, desire, since the tasks won't have been completed in which we've tried to be helpful? And secondly, what will the member states and Security Council be prepared to support, particularly in terms of financing? So those are all issues out there. Clearly, the major challenges in a country where there are no weekends and everything is a priority is rebuilding infrastructure, building a new, stable, Republican, well-supported, well-sustained army that respects human rights, developing institutional capacity, of which there's very little right now after decades of conflict and chronic instability, and malaise, creating a democratic political culture. They're wonderful words, but they've got to be put in practice here. Addressing root causes of instability, poverty, corruption, absence of justice, absence of good governance, et cetera. And then the international community is making a commitment to stay the course. And I'm often asked, well, do you have any fears? And I say the thing that concerns me most, which I do have some fear, is helping the Congolese to maintain the credibility of this process, the legitimacy of this process, and the credibility of MONUC. The two have to kind of go together. And what does that mean? It means on a daily basis producing results. If you don't produce results, you can't go back to the Security Council empty-handed and say, support me again. That means delivering, getting those foreign armed elements out of the country, conducting good elections, helping create a new army, helping create a new police force, helping them to push state authority out to the outer edges of the country where they're not for the time being. Those are all challenges that remain, and they are admittedly formidable. But so are the stakes, as Dr. Crocker said in his introduction. Great stakes here. But a successful post-conflict transition to Congo would benefit Africa as a whole more than would success in any other current African conflict. We've had successes in a couple other countries, but the Congo, a success there, has the possibility of changing the face of Africa. And that's, I think, what it's all about. And if we can help the Congolese to produce timely results across the board, the Congo could become a success story waiting to be told. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you very much, Bill. I now like to give the floor to our discussant, Bembidi Zolele, who will make some comments and some reactions, some responses, and then the floor will be open for your questions. Bemba, the microphone's yours.
Thank you, Dr. Crocker. Thank you, Ambassador Swing, for that background presentation. One word that keep on coming back to me is credibility. So as we stand here to discuss what is happening in Congo, what is most important for me is actually what's going to happen after the election. But in order to understand what's going to happen after the election and the issue of credibility, we need to go back to Sun City, the Sun City Accord, which was hammered between the belligerents, including the President Kabila's party. In my perspective, in my opinion, gave too much carrot, and there were no sticks. That is, people who had committed unspeakable crimes were given positions in the transitional government. For most of those people, with the exception of the civil opposition, which got a few seats, most of these people, the only leverage they had were their guns. They threatened to return to the battlefield. The international community yielded, and they found themselves in Kinshasa. So we found ourselves with a president and four vice presidents. Their mission was to bring about the territorial integrity of the country, reunite it, and raise the national army, and organize the elections. They gave them 2 years with the option to extend it twice, 6 months each time. Well, these people did not have any interest in holding the elections, partly because they found themselves in government without political mandate, without popular mandate, but with the risk of being prosecuted if a transparent system was put in place. you can imagine what kind of hurdle they were throwing away to make sure the election did not happen. So we found ourselves extending the election, the time one time, 6 months, nothing happened. 6 more months, nothing happened. And the election will be taking place outside that period, meaning time is run out fully. And now we're left with 1 month. The question is, how did we get from having 3 years, so to speak, 2 years with an option of having 3 years to prepare for the elections, but actually there's nothing set in place, and the election might not even still take place. That's one. So the credibility of the transitional government is zero, maybe even minus five. If you look on the size of MONUC, there's some serious credibility issues as well. 32 UN resolutions we heard about, but most of them very shaky in terms of implementation. I'll give examples. MONUC has had Chapter 7 mandate to enforce, to protect civilians from these militias since 2000. The ramp of implementation didn't really pick up until 2005. And by that, I'll give examples. There have been groups like Nkunda Batwari's group, Mutebusi, and many other militias that continue to threaten securities, the security of the region. We go back in, let's start with May 2004. Nkunda Batwari is a Tutsi Congolese who served in the armed forces, who's a dissident against his own RCD, which is the Rwanda-backed party or political military faction in the east. In May 2004, Nkunda attacked Bukavu in total defiance of the international community. He attacked Bukavu, laid siege on the city. While he was doing that, the UN had plenty of warnings to stop him. In fact, they'd counted some of his troops only to give up for whatever reasons, and Nkunda laid siege on the city about 2 weeks, and as he was getting ready to do so, the UN actually evacuated. And that was kind of the culmination of the UN credibility problem in Congo. The spokesperson for Kofi Annan at the time, Fred Eckhart, said, when they challenged him about the failure to implement this Chapter 7 mandate, when the fighting starts, our mandate stops. I don't know what that means. Another problem for those of us in Washington, we've seen a series of UN officials come through town, and every time you ask them, what about Chapter 7 mandate? The traditional answer had been, we don't have Chapter 7 mandate. So, of course, when you look at that, you wonder, are we making a mockery of the international community? Are we making a mockery of the Congolese people? What exactly are we doing? The ambassador mentioned that MONUC has a position on SEAD. So where we are today, my question will be, what has SEAD done to make sure, to make sure that the transitional government kept meeting its deadlines? Every time when they failed to meet the deadline, what did SEAD do, what did MONUC do to bring them on course? The issue of justice is very important. What has MONUC or the SEAD, again, I'm using MONUC and SEAD interchangeably here, kind of to represent the international community in Congo. What did they do as MONUC, as 1+4 kept on failing, and it was very obvious that they failed and fell along the way, and we kind of just baby them and push them along. We all have heard about the saying that if you give a monster a cookie, he'll be back for a jar of milk. You will be obliged to give the jar of milk because you gave the cookie in the first place. So in the case of Nkunda, he came back. In November 2005, he attacked and again laid siege in other places. A lot of people were displaced. As recently as January 2006, again, he attacked in the Rutshuru area. We have about 50 to 70,000 people displaced in the area. Now, these people still have their weapons. My question is, what are we doing about somebody like Nkunda Batware? He has his weapons. He has about anywhere from 4,000 to 1,200 people at his disposal, and with another 1,200 troops that are sympathetic to him in the region. So at any given day, he can rise and cause the same havoc, or wreak the same havoc that he did in the past. What does that mean? So that's one set of spoilers, and this go up. What did the international community do to curb the negative foreign forces? So I'm talking about Ugandan influence, Rwandan influence. We just saw what's happening in Ituri. It's kind of interesting. I say the Monuc regime reminds me of the Mobutu regime. And I'll explain. Mobutu created a system that made Mobutu indispensable. So the famous après le déluge, après moi c'est le déluge, you know, borrowing from King Louis the 15th sentence. So in the end, we start looking at Mobutu as the only option in the international community. What's the alternative? So today, the army has not been raised. We're supposed to have 18 brigades. We have about, at best, maybe 7, even though probably 12. Who's going to secure the country? Therefore, Monuc is to stay. So now we are in a position where we're all calling for the extension of Monuc's mandate, when in fact they had this time to help the country transition. What's going to happen tomorrow? Supposedly Kabila wins. I don't know if he's going to win or not. I'm not. But supposedly he wins. Okay. But let's just say, suppose he wins. He's the incumbent. He has the system behind him. Is he going to have enough power to help the country transition? When the people within his own entourage who are still arming militias, who are still forcing the system in the negative side, what does that mean for the country? We are in America, so I'm going to address actually some people from the State Department here. The U.S. has failed Congo, has failed the system. The U.S. is funding 25% of Monuc by default, because the agreement is not because the U.S. is so enamored with Congo, but because there's some agreement, long-standing agreement, that the U.S. is meeting. So it's nothing to do with Congo in that sense. But the U.S. has failed in bringing pressure to some of its people, meaning Rwanda, Uganda. So on one level, Monuc has this mandate that it's struggling to implement or to meet because you have people are challenging, defying the UN arms embargo, i.e. Rwanda, Uganda, through their proxies in Congo. What does that mean? We hear a lot about the tripartite or quadripartite or whatever it is. But that also is failing. I mean, it's okay to have Tsiangungu and Bukavu and Giseni and Goma. On paper is good, but when the FDLR negotiate with the Rwandan through the Sendigidio umbrella, and the FDLR actually renounces to its philosophy of genocide and say we're ready to go home, only to have Rwanda balk at the last minute and say you don't have any right to put any condition, what does that mean for the region? So the fear for the Congolese, and this is what we see a lot in sessions when you come here and see Congolese rise up in anger, is there's an entire constituency that is not heard. There's Monuc doing his business. There's the transitional government in Kinshasa stalling the process, and nobody's slapping them in the face. In terms of the justice system, the international justice, in 2005, the UN arrested Thomas Lubanga, who was the leader of the UPC up north in Ituri. But relatively, really, Thomas Lubanga is a small fish. What Congo needs is an example. Monuc is small, so it's true that when you compare it to Liberia, Congo is really big. But there's something called the threat of force, the threat to use force. If you couple it with the usage of force, people get the message. And unfortunately for Monuc, or fortunately for the Congolese, there's a precedent for this. In 2002, in 2003, the UN, through the European Union, sent a force of about 1,400 people, French mostly, called Artemis. It showed up in Bunia. At the time, Bunia was really a mess. The French showed up and made it clear from the beginning who was boss to this militia. Now, keep in mind, these militia are not armies. I mean, they're not really, for most part, they're not armed, they're not really professional armies. The kids with weapons, a 14-year-old with an AK-47 will kill you, that's true, but a 14-year-old with an AK-47 should not be able to sustain warfare with special forces from Guatemala or from Pakistan. It's just that simple. I serve in the military, so I can say that. I don't understand how the UN is having problem reining these people in. So those are some of the issues that we have today. What we need in the sense of justice, when Artemis came, they set the perimeter. Bunia was a city of 40,000 people. By the time Artemis finished its mission, Bunia was a bustling city of 120,000 people. Just to tell you how much peace they brought in the region. They also made it an effort to arrest some of these militias, when they did, they realized that the mandate was not to judge people. So what Artemis did was go back to the EU and tell them to fund a justice program in Bunia. They brought judges from various parts of Congo on rotational program. They can stay in Bunia, judging people, these militias, and providing justice. Can MONUC do that or not? Why can't we have a system like that in, again, MONUC is just the symbol I'm using, the international community, bring justice to the Kivus, bring justice in northern Katanga and other part of the region. Why are we seeing a lot of action in Ituri now and nothing in the Kivus? There's certain reasons that have been given, but then I think I will stop here. But the situation looks pretty bad, actually, when you look, you extrapolate on what's going to happen after the elections. Thank you.
A lot of issues have been opened up, and I think it's now time in the remaining roughly half hour we have, if you have a question. There's one microphone over here, and that's where you need to line up. And state your question, please, not a speech, not a sermon, a question, and then we'll move on. And I'd like to ask that the comments be in English. Thank you. Go ahead.
For the Ambassador Swing, I have a question for you.
Could you identify yourself, please, sir?
You met Amonga Chuchu for Congo Peace Initiative in the Kivus. I'm actually from Kivu. I want to refer to Mr. Swing, what he said about Interahamwe and the other militias who are in the Kivu. I don't want to ignore what Mr. Mbemba said, but when you have militias all around the Kivus who are getting one tribe of people, how do you defend yourself? I'm not saying about just justifying Nkunda, but even if you were to take Nkunda today, there will be another Nkunda tomorrow. What do you think about it? And also, to add to that question, there are a group of military guys who came to see Monique about the Brassage, who didn't want to be integrated because they believe that if they leave the region, their parents and relatives will be killed by militias who don't have any restraint. How do you solve that problem? What is your answer to their concerns? The last question is, we have so many refugees who are from that area, who are in Rwanda and Uganda, who didn't take part of enrollment. How are you going to solve the problem of those people who will not be represented? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Ambassador Swing, you may want to hear several questions and take them in a group.
Sure.
I don't know. Would that be better?
Sure.
Let's go ahead and take another couple of questions, and then we'll give the speakers a
chance. My name is Jean-Claude Makabangu. I'm the president of the Washington office of the UDPS. You know that the UDPS is the main opposition political party in Congo. My question is to Ambassador Swing. Because you are building a house on the top of the volcanoes, I have two questions. My first question, how are you going to put a democratic system in Congo by eliminating the main opposition party, the UDPS, out of system? And you are hoping that after that, you will have peace in Congo. That's my question. We send a memo to your office in Kinshasa about all the illegality in the system. I will raise one. Malumalu, I didn't give you an opportunity to the Reagan building to talk garbage to American people. He's from Kyiv. He was not elected, picked by the government. Malumalu in Kinshasa is protected by Kabila's militias. This is the chairman of the Federal Electoral Commission, protected. When he's moving from one part of Kinshasa, he's protected by Kabila's people. And in that commission, you have five people from Kivu, from those on his own state, and four from the government. And you ask Mr. Tshisekedi, I'm his advisor, to join a sinking boat. We don't control in this country, you are an American. The Federal Electoral Commission, you have a Democrat, a Republican, and an independent. But in Congo, you want to build democracy, you have five people from this boy, Apollinaire Malumalu, and four from the government, and you ask the main opposition party, me and Tshisekedi, to join that, we will not join. We send the revendication to your office in Kinshasa and to the UN. No answer. That's one. And the second one I want to raise, it is that your system were accusing you and Louis Michel, the European Commission, because Kabila gave you and the project that you are controlling the money in the country to explore diamond in Kasai, in my region, and you gave Kabila the opportunity to exclude systematically. You just said it, that the UDPS has to come in the provincial election. If Tshisekedi is not included, do you think that you are going to build the peace? The last question it is that the UDPS is, okay, the UDPS is fed up because now you are listening to the other people, because these people are criminal, they want to inform the provincial government. Now the UDPS is now moving to the third step. If you don't want to listen, the notification I send to your office, I have a memo, I will give you the memo after this debate. We are going to use force. We have people. Now we are going to use force because we don't want to understand. How are you going to solve that election? Because if Kabila, he cannot be elected. You know that. If he's elected, the way you are framing it, you are building a house on the top of the volcanoes.
Thank you very
much. We are going to use force. How are you going to solve the situation now in Congo? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know, Bill, if you want to comment at this point. Whenever a political leader announces to me that he is the main leader of a country, I always reach for my wallet. But I do think that that question and issue needs to be surfaced at some point. So do we want to stop at this point and take
sure.
the question, or should
we? Sure. Thanks very much. No, thank you very much for your comment. I'd be happy to, obviously, to receive the memo. I'm afraid there's probably a lot of unanswered mail from my office, and I apologize if yours was one of them. It wasn't intentional. We've maintained and continue to maintain a very close dialogue with UDPS. In fact, I invited them in right after they chose not to take part in the list of candidates for the presidency, basically just to say, we want to stay in touch. If you've decided to be an extra parliamentary opposition, then we still want to be in touch. We should be in touch. You have an important voice. I also told them that I'd like to know sort of where they are in their own thinking, so I could respond to that. And finally, to say to them, although you've chosen not to go into the presidential and the parliamentary elections, the candidates' lists are opening for the provincial elections. You have two provinces where you feel that is your home territory particularly strong. Sorry? No, let me just try to say what I'm trying to say. So there's another opportunity. We, as I said to you in my remarks, deeply regret the absence of UDPS from the contest. The UN, I can assure you, we are absolutely impartial. We have no candidate. We never will have one if we're going to do our work. If we lose our image of impartiality, we will not be able to accomplish our mandate. You have that 100% from me. I am totally impartial. I want the people of the Congo to have a chance finally to elect their own leaders, and that's what we're there for. On the issue of, I don't know, I didn't understand the portion about the diamonds and Cassis and all of that.
Louis Michel,
I represent the UN, not the European Union or Louis Michel. He's a good friend, but I can't really comment on that. But all I'm saying is that we would like to see the UDPS to be in the process. They're not in there. It's regrettable. Everyone tried. I sat in on the meeting Secretary General had with Mr. Tshisekedi, tried to convince him that it was important to be in the process, because even your criticism of the process is much more powerful if you inside the process rather than outside. And we had hoped that on the basis of that, other conversations Mr. Gaino had, conversations Mr. Solana and many others had, was all in the direction, and we worked hard. I mean, the last 3 days before the candidates list, I met pretty much nonstop with UDPS, RCD, with MLC, PPRD did not come. We were there till after 10 o'clock Saturday evening, before the Sunday afternoon closing of the candidates list, trying to work out a formula, trying to work out a compromise, trying to say, there's still time to do it. They could even work it out so that
It's like when you're in the bank and the shades are pulled down and you're in the line, you still get to make your deposit, a sort of a jeton type approach. That didn't work either. But I simply say I regret it. I hope that we can stay in touch. I will answer your memo. All I can say on that. On the other question, while I'm up quickly on the foreign armed groups, we have made this a top priority. It'll continue to be. We do not do repatriation by force. We are there to assist the FARDC, the Congolese Army, to do that. We, at the time of the crisis that you mentioned in Bukavu, we had 300 troops in town. We now have 2,500. We still have the same number of troops in the whole country as we had in Sierra Leone, 17,000 troops, and this is a country that's 24 times the size of Sierra Leone. So we've had by force to concentrate 87% of our troops in the Kivus and Ituri. 13 to 15 battalions are there. And again, I'm very sensitive about the Security Council. I'm not complaining. I'm explaining.
I think you just heard a request for more troops. I don't know. But we do have an example in a different country, in a different region, of a place that might have used a few more troops. So we all know what that issue is about. More troops. Bemba, you wanted to say a word or two about the UDPS question, and then we'll go back to the line.
Okay. Actually, I want to address the question Meta posed. Nkunda probably has some grievances in the east. You know, before the Rwandan invasion, I presume you grew up in Kivu.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, so before the Rwandan invasion, we Congolese live in relative peace among ourselves. You were not harassed every day. So I'm not sure. I have a lot of friends who are Tutsi who come from the region. The person who taught me to swim was Tutsi, my best friend as a kid. But the point I'm trying to make is this. We lived in peace among Congolese. When there was no, there are always issues. Issues exist. But we live in relative peace. Today, we have a proliferation of militias. You're not going to sit here and tell me the only solution to that will be an escalation of more things. If Nkunda or anybody else, it doesn't have to be Nkunda, it can be people in Ituri, wherever, in Bakongo, if they have grievances, well, let's work on those grievances. Let's work on them. It doesn't make any sense. We saw people here demonstrate for citizenships. They carried flags on the streets. They protested. There are many other things. So I do agree if there's a problem with the brassage, and I understand there have been a lot of problems. Well, the UN is there, is doing that. Those concerns should be voiced, and those people should be dealt with. So that's why I'm saying the justice dimension of this transition is actually more important than even the elections. For you, for your community, for all our communities. So I have nothing particular against Kunda. I don't think he's the only one they should go after. The plenty of people they should go after. But some justice needs to be brought along across the board for everybody. In terms of UDPS, I think there's a serious problem. One, for the average Congolese doesn't understand what UDPS want. So it is important to say to the international community what UDPS want. But more important is to say to the Congolese what the problem is. I'll give an example. I believe SEAD could have done a better job in engaging UDPS, in engaging Tshisekedi. He's a sphinx, he's a legend, he's the father of the opposition. That is true. But that doesn't give him any entitlement. However, without him, the election cannot be credible. So SEAD and international community, it behooves them to really engage the fellow and his party. However, for the Congolese, I think UDPS has dropped the ball across the board every single time. So today, if you exclude yourself out of the referendum, let me finish, please. If you exclude yourself, no, this is not a discussion. I'm responding. Kamba, I'm responding. If UDPS has grievances and they thought the Constitution was wrong, they should have explained to the people why the people should reject it during the referendum. We would have not been where we are today. So that's all I have to say about it.
Thank you very much. I think in the interest of time and fairness, let me take three or four questions here, and then we'll have another round of responses, and then another batch if we have the time. So could you keep your question very precise? Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, thanks, Mr. Dizzolelli and Ambassador Swing. My name is Josh Marks from Small Arms Survey. I had a question regarding joint operations and MONUC support for the Congolese army. And it was interesting because in the video you showed, you highlighted Ninja, where a few weeks after those operations, the Congolese army was accused of creating greater human rights abuses than the FDLR in the area. And secondly, you also mentioned Ituria as well, where in February, and currently Congolese army is accused of, again, causing more trouble than the actual militia groups in the area. My question then is regarding Ituri. How will the jointness of operations between MONUC and the Congolese army and also MONUC's support for the Congolese army in Ituri evolve in the coming weeks, especially given recent unsettling reports about increasing rebel activity in that area?
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Serge Senga with Dignity. I want to thank both Ambassador Mr. Dizolele, great job. I want to direct this to Ambassador Swing. You mentioned in your remarks that you were responsible for success and failure along with the government. I'd like to get your position on how, if you could respond, because Vimba did mention that. What is the part of responsibility that the SIAT is taking, because there was a failure to deliver on June 30th, 2005, and a failure to deliver beyond the time that was required, beyond the extension that was reasonably thought. So what part of responsibility, and what's going to be done about that? The other question I had is, you mentioned that you also were encouraging for some soldiers to come from other nations to support the electoral process to help during the time of elections. I'd like to know where you intend to get them dispatched and how you're going to do this, because I'm afraid that most of them will go in Kinshasa assuring security for the political leaders where the population really needs help in the eastern part and Katanga. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Jacques Mushagasha, and thank both the ambassador and Mr. Dizolela for the great job they did. My question is about election, the credibility of election. And I'll start with what Mr. Vemba said about Kunda, and I'll read this from the human rights. I'll start with the BBC.
We don't need a whole lot of lengthy
reading. I won't read the law. I just read one page. It said this, confidential, no one page, one paragraph, sorry. Confidential UN documents seen by BBC say that General Kunda is Rwanda's military chief in DR Congo, through whom they control much of the area. I read also this from Human Rights New York. It says, asked by Human Rights Watch researchers by UN peacekeeper, why UN peacekeepers had not assisted in arresting Kunda, one senior UN official mentioned possible repercussions from Rwanda as one reason. Now, according to many documents that we've seen, we saw that the electoral process in Congo is being hijacked by Rwanda and Uganda, and the UN knows what is going on. Why are you rushing Congolese people into elections that you know that will be failure? That's the first question. The second question, you mentioned here that we have 68 million people in Congo. They go far to 63 million. 25 million Congolese who were registered as voters represents 98% of Congolese between the age of 18 and over, those who are allowed to vote, 98%. Do we believe that really 98% of people in a country without road, without bridge, without anything, we are really registered? We Congolese, we believe and we know that electoral kits were cheated, were stolen, taken to Rwanda, to Burundi, to Uganda, and many Rwandese, Burundian, and Ugandese were registered as Congolese. Now, where is the credibility of the elections into which we are, you are harassing the Congolese people. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you. We have that question is very clear. We want to know both why the elections are so delayed and why they are being rushed. So yes, me.
I need to translate. And oui, parce que Monsieur Crocker, je ne suis pas d'accord avec vous quand vous avez dit il faut parler seulement en anglais. Nous sommes concernés par cette procédure d'élection, nous les Congolais, et le sentiment que nous avons que vous on nous met de côté, nous les Congolais.
The sentiment I expressed about English is the working language of this meeting, so we need to have some translation if you would like to get your message across.
OK. Monsieur Bemba a souligné ici que tout est mal parti de Sun City, tout en sachant bien, comme on l'a dit aujourd'hui, le sentiment que nous, les Congolais, nous avons, c'est qu'on affirme de plus en plus le contrôle du Rwanda sur le Congo. Ceux à qui on avait donné le pouvoir, c'était des rébellions fatoches. Ce n'était pas des rébellions authentiques congolaises. C'était des rébellions fomentées par le Rwanda et l'Ouganda. Et c'est à eux qu'on a donné le pouvoir. Le Rwanda et l'Ouganda ont continué à contrôler le Congo. C'est simple, tout l'Est est sous contrôle rwandais. Ça, tout le monde le sait. Monsieur Swing, l'échec de la transition...
You want to translate? I think the point is very clear, and it's in one sentence. So please go ahead.
Yeah, what she just said is that from the beginning, from the onset, the process was wrong at the Sun City Accord, because those who were at the table were already backed by Rwanda and Uganda.
L'échec de la transition n'est pas du tout une surprise pour nous, les Congolais. Ces gens-là, non seulement n'ont pas eu, ne représentaient pas le peuple congolais, mais ce sont des gens qui, la première fois de leur vie, se sont retrouvés ministres. Ils n'ont jamais travaillé de leur vie. Et c'est à eux que vous avez confié le pouvoir. Maintenant, cet échec-là, M. Swing, est-ce que ce n'est pas votre échec à vous, personnellement? Parce que vous avez été chargé de la transition. Et pendant tout... Vous êtes du comité d'accompagnement de la transition, le CIAT. C'est vous, M. Swing. Alors, pendant toute la transition, vous avez dénoncé, comme c'est devenu l'habitude, tous les détournements, toute la corruption, tout ce qui se passe de mauvais... Vous avez toujours dénoncé, mais qu'avez-vous fait pour ce pauvre peuple congolais?
Okay, thank you very much. And
je n'ai pas fini.
Yeah.
La grande question sur l'implication, le rôle du bradage minier et de pillage des ressources naturelles. Monsieur Louis Michel a dit ceci, qui peut nous empêcher, nous les Européens, de faire du Congo ce que les Américains ont fait de l'Irak et de l'Afghanistan à cause du patrimoine minier qu'ils sont en train de se distribuer au Congo. Voilà le problème.
I think that's enough. Do you want to say a word of translation?
One sentence. She just asking if Mr. Swing, would you accept responsibility in the failure of the transition in the Congo?
Yes, sir. Please identify yourself.
Loa Kabwanga, president of Parico, aux États-Unis. I'm sorry to. Are we going in French because Congo is still a French speaking country? Monsieur Swing, j'ai une question qui est relative à la situation présente qui prévaut au pays. Il s'avère que depuis l'échec de la commission électorale indépendante de mettre sur pied les élections selon les dates que nous avions tous convenues à Sun City, il s'avère que des voix s'élèvent. La communauté catholique a parlé. Certains partis politiques, notamment l'UDPS et ceux que je représente, ont parlé. Nous vous avons écrit officiellement à vous, vous demandant de mettre sur pied un dialogue qui permettrait à tous les partis, qui permettrait à toutes les associations qui ont été représentés à Sun City, de s'asseoir ensemble et de mettre sur pied un programme qui permettrait un meilleur calendrier du processus électoral, dont vous savez très bien qu'aujourd'hui, il n'est garanti de rien, étant donné que l'ensemble du territoire congolais n'est pas encore sécurisé. Ma question est claire. Êtes-vous pour un dialogue avant la date que M. Malou Malou nous a donnée en vue de sécuriser le processus? Je vous remercie.
Bill, you may wish to translate that, or I can have a go at it. This is an English-speaking meeting, my friends, and I insist on the questions being placed in English. I don't care what the official language of the Congo is. We are in the United States of America, and French is not an official language here. My sense is that the question to you, Bill, is, are you prepared to consider further dialogue before we get to the end point in the pre-electoral period?
Exactly.
Should we break here for a couple of questions, for a couple of answers?
Yeah,
I think we probably should.
Yeah, I'll try to be very. Yeah. I'll try to be very brief. A number of the questions here. The small arms question. You're correct in your observation. It is true that Ninja was retaken. It is also a matter of growing concern that the new Congolese army, the FARDC, is increasingly becoming a major source of human rights violations, to the point that in some cases people are looking to others for protection from the FARDC. That is a fact. I can't dispute it. It's a major, major issue. And if you have to identify one priority that has to be number two after the elections, it is the army. And I said to them recently that if they continue down the road they're going, that we will soon have reunited all of the elements for failure with the army. So we've got to work hard on that one. Absolutely right. I agree with you. Ituri, we have also lost ground in Ituri. Absolutely correct. As I speak, we are putting together a larger, more global Ituri action plan with the government in which we recognize two parameters. One, there is no military solution without a political framework, and there is no political solution without military pressure. So we're working hard on that. We're prepared to talk to the rebel chiefs, the few that are left there, if they wish. But meanwhile, we will be going ahead with major military operations in support of the Congolese army, which now has three brigades in Ituri. And we have asked for major changes in what we consider to be a weak leadership structure there right now. So we're doing things on that. Question of the date. The Secretary General was very clear on this when he was in Kinshasa and Kisangani. He said it is not some fetish of a date, but the quality of the elections that will count. The elections were moved in the first instance largely because the legislative cadre was not yet in place. This is a parliament. It took a while to get all the laws passed. They've got it now. The most recent move from 18 June to 30 July was largely technical. People have no idea what is involved in registering nearly 26 million people, as you yourself said, in a country that has no roads, no ID cards in memory, no census in 20 years, no vote since 1960. So there is a lot involved in it, and it's not just as simple as saying, on X date we'll have elections. Virtually all of the dates that have been missed is because these were dates that were set for political reasons that did not take into consideration the technical constraints that are involved in doing elections in a massive country like this. Quickly, electoral credibility. A lot of talk about Laurent Nkunda. I can tell you from my perspective, my own assessment is there is nothing out there of an armed nature that will keep these elections from happening. Nkunda, the FDLR, the Interahamwe, the XFAR, they represent a threat to the Congolese people, not so much to the neighborhood, and they represent a threat to regional relations. I base my judgment on this because they did not disturb voter registration over 5 months. They did not disturb the referendum. They realize their time is over. They want to draw as little attention as possible to themselves, and my prediction is that while there may be pockets where one or two places where people can't vote, it is not going to be a major issue. What was it, something else based on? Oh, the 98%. We don't know how many. We made an estimate. Somewhere we thought between 26 and 28 million probably be eligible. There's no census out there. How would you know? We guessed 20. So if you take the estimate of 28 million, you got 25.6, that probably is 98%.
But the original estimate was probably wrong. And we can't, we don't have, if you had taken time to do a census, you would be doing these elections several years later. The one where we get this business about tout est mal parti and about the question that everything's going to hell in a handbasket, that is not my reading. That is not my reading. I invite you, if you're here in Washington, come back to your country and see what it looks like. Come back and see the realities there. No one believes that. People are generally encouraged in the Congo. They're encouraged because they know the people want to vote. They're encouraged because people have had it. They've had enough. They're war fatigue. They want to pull out of this. They want to change the paradigm from one where the Africa's richest countries become the world's poorest. We don't want that. They want to change. And the international support is there. So I just don't accept any of those assumptions. Therefore, I can't accept responsibility for the failure of the transition. The transition hasn't failed. I mean, you have to change your assumptions. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be flipping on that. And the failure of the CEI to maintain the electoral date, I've just explained it. It's on technical grounds, and surely you want to have not just any old election, but a good election. We've even been accused of trying to help the Congo to have too good a quality of election. We spent too much money on electoral cards. I think the Congolese people develop a proper, they deserve a proper electoral card, a voter registration card. There'll be other elections after this, because not the first election that counts. It's the second and the third and the fourth and so forth. Thanks.
Okay, we have time for maybe two more very concise questions. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ben Kalala. I am the president of the Congolese community of Atlanta, Georgia, flew in to see Mr. Swing for these questions. I am also a candidate for the provincial elections that are taking place in the Congo. I just returned from the Congo myself, so I do know the reality of the Congolese people. Mr. Swing, Kofi Annan was recently in Kinshasa when I was there. He himself witnessed 5,000 to 6,000 people in the streets of Kinshasa in a peaceful demonstration to protest the way these elections are going. He witnessed it. He was right there himself, peacefully. Mm-hmm. Kofi Annan was given a memo by the leader of UDPS, Mr. Tshisekedi, personally. In that memo, the UDPS is asking three things: to reopen the center for registration so UDPS, the people that did not register, can go ahead and register to vote. And the children that was not 18 at that time when they closed the doors can also have the right to vote. They have extended the transition more than three times. I don't think there was a problem for the doors, for even for 1 week, to be reopened for the members of UDPS to register to vote. I don't think that was asking for too much. The second thing that was in that memo was that the UDPS be included in the monitoring process of the elections represented. And the third thing was that the HAM, the Haute Autorité des Médias, be also able to control the way these elections are going to be conducted. I don't think out of these three recommendations, revendications, there's something extra that they were asking for. Kofi Annan came back to the United States. To this point, we don't know what is the outcome of that. And I want to ask you the first question. Why are you here after Kofi Annan went to Congo, talked about this, with all these African leaders that you showed us today? Why are you here in the United States? And the second question is, Kabila, as a presidential candidate, has broken the law from what we know. The Constitution, Congolese Constitution, states that no military or no police should be involved in the elections. Kabila registered as a candidate, first as an elector, while he was still in the military. Now he's a candidate to the presidential. He's still, and then he wrote himself a démission, la lettre de démission. He understands. He wrote himself a resignation letter, and he signed it It did not go to the Ministry of Defense the way it's supposed to be done. He signed it, and 1 year later, he's the candidate to the presidential. Today, 11 candidates, presidential candidates, are standing up today as we speak to demand that the candidacy of Joseph Kabila be null and void because he broke the law. What is your position about that?
Thank you. Sir, last question for you, sir, and then we have final wrap-up here.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ambassador Swing. Americans don't get too much time. I will be very fast because they have not too much time to hear if we spoke too much. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Swing, and thank you, the forum. Mr. Swing, Mr. Ambassador, excuse me. Thank you, His Excellency, and the most respectful, Mr. Ambassador William Swing. I will speak your one word in Kinshasa. You said yourself in Lingala, when you was being a U.S. ambassador to DRC at 2001, you said, quote, the crocodile and the catfish, both of them lived in the water. Now, if the catfish came and tell you that the crocodile is sick in the water, don't deny, because both of them, they live in the water. And you, Mr. Ambassador, is your one word regarding the Congolese negotiation, what is happening now. Can you say something? Because after all, you are the big boss, and everybody respects you too much, and I don't want to take too much time. It's the best of the Congolese, it's the best of the election, and we want you to be neutral because you are a respectful person, as I know you, as I know many persons who knows you. Thank you so much. I will not speak too much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Who would like to have the last word here? Bemba, do you want to say a word?
Okay,
Yeah. We have a word from Bemba Dizolele and then a word from Bill Swing.
I just think the Congolese people want to move on. It's a political process, the consideration. Frankly, the people are fed up. They've heard about all the diplomatic statesmen. They've heard why the U.S. is not doing what it's supposed to do. They've heard why the U.N. is failing, what limitations they have. At the end of the day, the people entrusted Kabila when he negotiated in Sun City. The people expected him to deliver, that when they came, even UDPS agreed, says, okay, go ahead. Show us what you're capable of doing. Now is no longer the time to do that. Even with UDPS, this is no longer the time. We knew what the cabinet of Malumalu was. It's not something we just found out now. So there are a lot of process that need to be taken. I think now in the interest of Congo, we all need to be practical. I don't know if July 30th is the best date or not. All I know is that the Congolese people want to move on. We don't want Monkunda, we don't want MRC in Ituri. We want to live the way we lived before. At least get this thing behind us and set our country on track. It might take 20 years to get back to where we were. At least let's have the peace and move forward.
I think the last question asked sort of what's a sort of summing up statement. Summing up statement as follows. First of all, Congolese people are closer to having free, transparent, and democratic elections than they have ever been since 1960. I think what my colleague Mbemba said is absolutely right. They want to move on. Now, if we want to sit here and criticize this part or that part, that's fine. That's all part of democracy. But the caravan is moving on. We also need to understand that the Congolese people, I'm glad you quoted that wonderful Lingala proverb. I can, if some of the Congolese don't remember which one it is, I'll give it to you again. But it is correct. The fish and the crocodile live in the same water, and therefore, if the fish tells you the crocodile is sick, you better believe him because they live in the same water. So I'm listening to you, but I can tell you what listening I've done tells me that the Congolese people really want these elections. They would not have come out in the numbers they did and come out twice, once to register, once to vote. And thirdly, bear in mind that we are in heavy competition for resources. We're one of 18 missions in the world. You will have two things. I can tell you what will happen. Elections. If you have a good election, which we expect you to have, expectations are going to rise exponentially, and great pressure will be on the from the member states to reduce drastically Monick's budget and other support for the Congress. So you will have a widening gap. That's the one thing that will keep me awake at night, that widening gap between expectations that are very justified and support that is declining. So we need to be doing what we can to keep this process credible and say it's not perfect, this has happened, that's happened, but move on. Move on. The 18-year-olds who didn't register, okay, there'll be another election, they will register. Anyway, thank you very much. I think that the Congo is on a good path, and I thank you for it.
Thank you all for your participation. Our meeting is closed.
So before you get sworn, can I get a card? I'm going to, actually, I'm planning on being embedded with UN troops in Ituri.
Okay.
So when I'm in Kinshasa,
okay.
I will
good.
Stop by.
Good,
so
I'll give him a card right now. Hey, how are you? Thank you very much. That's the one. Okay. Good. Good to see you.
I'm not against you, but that's okay.
I know.
I want to be understood when you talk about it.
We want to be ambassador.
We want to be ambassador.